Hi, I'm Henrietta, and I'm delighted today to bring you a very special edition of the Shedding Light Show. You're usually here, when you hear the show, you usually hear Bird Hale at this hour, and Bird is the show's superb host, but today you have me. And in the past, I've been on the show as Bird's guest. I am the founder and editor of the East Palo Alto Today newspaper, which features the news and profiles from the city of East Palo Alto. I also host a television show called Talking with Henrietta, which is produced at the Media Center in Palo Alto. Today, I am just fortunate to sit in for Bird, and I'm doubly fortunate to have as my guest Michelle Alexander, who will be talking with me by phone from Ohio. Michelle Alexander is currently on leave from Ohio State University, where she is a law professor. And prior to joining the law school, Professor Alexander was a member of the Stanford Law School faculty, where she served as director of the Civil Rights Clinic. For several years, Professor Alexander served as the director of the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU of Northern California, and following law school, she clerked for Justice Harry A. Blackmun on the United States Supreme Court. We're talking to Professor Alexander today because she has written a book that's getting attention throughout the country. The book is called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Welcome to the show, Professor Alexander.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, it's just a delight to be able to talk to you, finally. What city are you in?
Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio.
Ohio State, yes.
Yes. Now, in the book, you've said that there is a new caste system in America. What do you mean by that, and how is that existing or dependent upon the incarceration rates of minority members from minority communities?
Yes. Well, the book argues that within a few decades after the collapse of Jim Crow, we as a nation have managed to recreate racial caste in America. With the election of Barack Obama, of course, it's widely believed that we've finally triumphed over race, but the reality is quite different. In some major American cities, the majority of African American men are locked behind bars or labeled felons for life. And once labeled felons, you're trapped in a permanent second-class status in which you may be denied the right to vote, automatically excluded from juries, legally discriminated against in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits, many of the old forms of discrimination that we supposedly left behind in the Jim Crow era are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon.
Now, some people would say that they are in behind bars because of their own fault. They have broken the laws, so they are understandably incarcerated. And what would you say to that?
Well, yes, you know, the popular supposedly colorblind justification for the mass incarceration of people of color is crime rates. But as I describe in some detail in my book, crime rates do not even begin to explain the astounding and rapid increase in imprisonment in African American communities. The war on drugs is the primary cause of the prison boom. It's a war that has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies consistently show, have shown for decades, that people of color are no more likely than whites to use or sell illegal drugs.
So how do you go from the war on drugs to the mass incarceration of young black men?
Well, you know, in the past few decades, our prison population has quintupled, not doubled, tripled, quintupled. We've gone from a prison population of about 300,000 to more than 2 million in the space of just a couple of decades. And this has not been the result of rising crime rates. Over the past few decades, crime rates have fluctuated, and today are actually at historical lows, but incarceration rates have consistently soared. And this is because of the war on drugs. You know, drug convictions are the single greatest contributor to the expansion of the prison system.
If drug use is illegal and young men are guilty of using drugs, they've broken the law, right?
Yes, absolutely, but this is what people fail to recognize. You know, black youth are being arrested, incarcerated, and branded felons for the very same drug activity that goes ignored on college campuses, universities, and white suburban neighborhoods all the time. We are all criminals. Every one of us has violated the law at some time in our lives. We've either drank underage, experimented with drugs, maybe sped on the freeway. You know, all of us have broken the law. But only some of us are targeted by law enforcement, you know, rounded up, arrested en masse, branded felons at young ages. And, you know, again, the popular conception is that, you know, most of the folks who are being arrested and imprisoned are guilty of violent crimes. That's not the case. You know, the overwhelming majority of those who've been arrested in the drug war have been for minor nonviolent offenses. For example, in 2005, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for simple possession. Only 1 out of 5 were for sales. You know, most people in state prison today for drug offenses have no history of violence or significant selling activity. And, you know, the 1990s, which, you know, was the greatest period of expansion of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession. You know, a drug less harmful than alcohol or tobacco and equally as prevalent in, you know, middle class, white communities, college campuses, as it is in the hood. But the war has been waged almost exclusively in poor black and brown communities. Young kids, you know, are often stopped and searched, you know, as they're walking to school. Their backpacks are rifled through in the hopes of finding drugs. Once they can drive, you know, their cars are pulled over, sometimes dismantled in the search for drugs.
So how do you explain this? Are you saying it's racial profiling and these young men and women are specifically being targeted?
Yes.
Why?
The answer is yes. Well, in order to understand why, you have to get a sense of the history of the drug war. You know, most people assume that the war on drugs was launched in response to rising drug crime rates or the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities. But that's not the case. The current drug war was officially declared in 1982 by President Ronald Reagan, and it was declared at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline. It was declared a few years before crack hit the streets, first in Los Angeles and later spread to poor communities of color across America. So why was a drug war declared at a time when drug crime was on the decline, of not much concern? Well, because the drug war was waged in response to racial politics, not drug crime. The drug war was part of the Republican Party's kind of grand strategy of using racially coded, get-tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare in order to appeal to poor and working-class white voters, particularly in the South, who were resentful of and disaffected by, threatened by, the civil rights movement, particularly desegregation, busing, and affirmative action.
Well, did this happen at the same time as the whole Willie Horton issue that popped up?
Yes, that was all, exactly. The Willie Horton, you know, campaign ads are a prime example of how the Republican Party was using kind of racially coded political appeals on issues of crime in an attempt to appeal to poor and working class white voters, the so-called, you know, swing voters. You know, pollsters and Republican Party strategists found that by using those kind of racially coded, you know, appeals, get tough appeals on crime and welfare, they could persuade you know, white voters who had been members of the Democratic Party in the South to defect from the Democratic Party and join the Republican Party. And so the war on drugs was actually Ronald Reagan's attempt to make good on campaign promises to get tough on a group of people who had not so subtly been defined as black in the media and political discourse, and they got lucky because a couple years after Reagan officially declared the war on drugs, crack hit the streets in inner cities across America. And what did the Reagan administration do in response? They hired staff whose job it was to publicize inner-city crack babies, crack whores, crack dealers. They actually launched a media campaign to publicize inner-city crack use, abuse, and related violence in the hopes that they could build public support for the drug war and turn it, transform it from a rhetorical war into a literal one.
Now, it seems to me, it's amazing that you use the term, they got lucky. So, how is it that they got lucky? Was this just coincidental? I know in your book you talk about drugs being brought into this country intentionally, and the government knew about it, and those drugs were being distributed throughout minority communities. Is that part of the luck that you're talking about?
Well, the CIA has admitted that it knew that, Nicaraguan drug dealers were importing drugs into Los Angeles, drugs in the form of cocaine that, helped to kind of give rise to the crack epidemic. The CIA has admitted that it knew about this and did nothing to stop it. Now, the CIA has not admitted, nor has any evidence been produced to support the claim that, it was intentionally seeking the destruction of the black community by failing to stop the importation of drugs into the United States. But what is certainly beyond doubt is that within a few years after the drug war was declared by President Ronald Reagan, a drug epidemic emerged.
Yes, now it seems it emerged.
They were able to capitalize on that drug epidemic and then use it as an excuse for the mass imprisonment of people of color.
Was there an epidemic likewise within other communities and suburban communities?
Well, what's interesting actually is that at the time, at the peak of the kind of media frenzy surrounding crack cocaine, there was actually no data available regarding the number of crack-related, deaths, overdoses, or, information relating to the seriousness of the crack epidemic. At that time, at the peak of the frenzy, all of the information was just anecdotal, just these kind of sensational stories that were being played out in the media. What we now know, though, is that even at the peak of the crack epidemic, the number of people who were, dying as a result not only of crack addiction but also crack-related violence was a tiny, tiny fraction of the number of deaths that could be attributable to alcohol abuse.
Well, we know that there is, let us say, a real difference in the way alcohol is looked at within this country and crack is looked at within this country.
Absolutely.
Alcohol is an acceptable drug, whereas crack is not an acceptable drug. And
yes,
we then have to look at the different forms of cocaine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and of course, powder cocaine has been dealt with far less harshly than crack cocaine. The public perceives powder cocaine is to be a drug of choice of white Americans, and crack has been, associated with African Americans, and it's no surprise then that the punishment for, possession or sale of crack cocaine is about 100 times as severe as that for powder cocaine. You get a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence for, possessing if the amount of cocaine that you need for a 5-year mandatory sentence is 100 times greater than the amount of crack that is needed for the identical sentence. So, the punitiveness that swept the nation in response to the images that, flooded our television sets as a result of this media campaign that was conducted by the Reagan administration to publicize crack use and abuse. That media campaign resulted in the saturation of our television sets with images of black and brown drug users and crack babies, and a wave of punitiveness swept the nation that clearly would not have taken hold if the images associated with crack use had been white.
Now, one could very well say, if one accepts what you've said, that all of this came from a strategy by the Republicans to make the most of and enlist the sympathies of white Southerners. But what is it that made it take hold and continue going beyond just the political strategy?
Well, there's two things that happened. First is that Democrats began competing with Republicans over that same group of white swing voters, and soon Democrats tried to prove that they could be even tougher on quote-unquote them, the group of people who had been demonized in the media. And so, the greatest expansion of our prison system occurred during President Clinton's administration, not during Ronald Reagan's, and many of the laws that discriminate against people who have felonies were passed during the Clinton administration. For example, the laws that bar, felons from public housing for a minimum of 5 years, and that deny to, drug felons food stamps for the rest of their lives. Those laws were, part of the Clinton administration's effort to prove they could be even tougher on crime and on welfare than their Republican predecessors. So once Democrats and Republicans began competing with each other to prove who could be tougher, sentences became longer and more harsh, and there was virtually no political resistance to the waging of this war in poor communities of color. But another thing happened, which is that the Reagan administration put into place financial incentives that guaranteed that this war would be waged aggressively for a very long time. Again, at the time the drug war was launched, drug crime was not a serious serious problem in many communities, and so many even conservative law enforcement officials initially resisted the idea of waging a drug war. They said, why should we shift our attention away from murder, rape, robbery, more serious offenses that people are concerned about, and focus our attention on low-level drug use or dealing?
Did you say Southern officials?
Conservative.
Oh, conservative officials.
Law enforcement. Yes. Officials even resisted at first. And so how did the Reagan administration overcome this initial resistance and reluctance? Well, basically through bribes. Cash grants were made available to state and local law enforcement officials that were willing to wage this war aggressively. So state and local law enforcement agencies across the nation are given federal funding based on the number of drug arrests they make, the sheer volume.
Oh, and they're not given funding for any other types of arrests?
Well, the federal funding that's made available through the drug war is specifically for drug arrests. And again, there's no incentive built in to ensure that drug kingpins are brought down, or even that law enforcement, officials go after the most violent offenders. No. The funding is based on volume, sheer numbers of drug arrests.
And that still is in existence?
Yes. The Edward Byrne Memorial Grant Program provides federal funding to state and local law enforcement agencies that increase the volume of their drug arrests. And so, suddenly you saw, local law enforcement agencies across the country devoting, incredible amounts of time, energy, and resources to drug law enforcement when they never had before, and developing these, drug law enforcement task forces and SWAT teams, all aimed at, increasing dramatically the volume of drug arrests. And that's a large part of why, millions of people have been branded, arrested and branded drug felons.
Now, one would say, it would be easy to say, you can't arrest people in spite of the volume of grants or the number of grants given. on the basis of how many people are arrested if there aren't people out there using drugs.
Well, so, this is the reality. There are millions of people in every community, community, folks of every race, every nationality, every class background use drugs. To the same extent. So, if you choose to go looking for drugs in any community in the United States, you will find them.
Now, there are those who would say that the violent crimes are perpetrated in the minority communities.
Well,
because they're poor and they need their drug fix, they're therefore committing violent crimes to get the money to feed their habit.
Well, what's interesting, again, is that, the studies that have been done suggest that the arrests, again, the drug arrests, are overwhelmingly of people who do not have histories of violence or significant selling activity. I tell people all the time, if you are concerned about violent crime in your neighborhood, then you should oppose the war on drugs, because law enforcement is investing its scarce resources in rounding up, youth of color for minor drug offenses, treating them like, criminals at young ages, subjecting them to humiliating stops and search that sends the message to them that they're going to prison one way or the other, no matter what, branding these folks felons, therefore ensuring that they will be largely unemployable for the rest of their lives. If you're interested in ending violent crime in your community, you need to end the war on drugs and ask law enforcement to, devote its scarce resources to more serious crimes in your community, and also stop creating a lower caste of individuals that will forever be locked out.
Well, it seems, and I wonder, should I call you Michelle or should I call you Professor Alexander?
Whatever you're comfortable with is fine by me.
It seems that creating this lower caste would not be in the interest of this country in terms of its development, in terms of its ability to compete. That would be a very short-sighted policy.
Yes, I'm so glad you raised that, because, every caste system in the United States is uniquely tailored to the economic, social, and political context of the time. Now, slavery was a system really based on economic exploitation, exploiting black labor. Jim Crow was a system that was primarily about subordination, locking black folks into a permanent second-class status. They were locked into a lower tier of jobs. Well, mass incarceration is really about marginalization. Now, what does that mean? Well, over the last few decades, our economy has gone through a profound transition. We used to be, during slave times, the agrarian economy drove the United States. Then we had an industrial economy where factory work was the backbone of the nation. In fact, as recently as 1970, the majority of black men in urban areas held factory jobs. Well, those jobs have disappeared. Factories have closed down or moved overseas. And, in a wonderful book called When Work Disappears by William Julius Wilson, he shows that, inner city communities collapsed as a result of factories closing down in Chicago, Los Angeles, urban areas across America. And the sudden drastic increase in joblessness in communities that were once relatively stable, ghetto areas that we think of today were actually thriving, a few decades ago because jobs were plentiful. Well, joblessness has rendered, relatively unskilled black labor useless, right?
Yes.
Because now there's no more factories. As I say, no longer needed to pick cotton in the fields or work in factories. Black and brown men are now viewed as largely disposable.
Well, at the same time,
they have been rounded up in mass, warehoused, and then put to work often in prison.
But those jobs going overseas affected the rest of America, too. So it wasn't just black men who've been rendered unemployed.
Well, yes, that's true, although, again, I really encourage folks who are interested in kind of understanding better why inner-city communities kind of collapse to read When Work Disappears. You know, that book explains very well that although, you know, factories closing and deindustrialization has affected all Americans, no one has been more affected than African American men.
Now, how
they have been hardest hit because factories were often located in urban areas in order to have easy access to cheap labor.
Let's talk about something else, Professor Alexander, and that's the rise of the penal institutions, just the numbers of them. Would you agree that building penal institutions has become big business?
Absolutely, yes. It's become an enormous business. You know, in a couple of ways. One is, you know, the prison system and our criminal justice system now employs vast numbers of people. You know, as I said earlier, our prison population has quintupled. So, you know, if we were to just try to go back to the incarceration rates we had in the 1970s, you know, a time when many civil rights activists actually thought that rates of incarceration were egregiously high. But if we were just to go back to the incarceration rates of the 1970s, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today.
Ooh.
More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Prisons across America would close, many of which are now located in, you know, predominantly white rural communities, and prisons have now become the economic base for many of these communities in ways that are similar to, you know, how plantations were the economic base of rural communities in an earlier era. So, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs, actually 1 million jobs, are at stake. You know, when we start talking seriously about downsizing the prison system. But beyond that, you know, private prisons have become big business. The American Correctional Corporation, the largest, you know, private prison company, is listed on, you know, the stock exchange, and is one of the few extremely profitable businesses in a time of economic recession. Corporations now use prison labor for a wide range, you know, of work. And so, you know, yes, absolutely.
You talk about it as the new Jim Crow, but the way you explain it, describe it, it sounds like a new form of slavery.
Well, you know, I say that the experience when you're in prison is akin to slavery. The experience when you're out of prison is like a new Jim Crow. Because once you've been released from prison, you are denied all the same rights, many of the same rights that were supposedly won during the civil rights era. Once you're released from prison, you can be denied the right to vote. You're automatically deemed ineligible for jury service. And, you know, you're legally discriminated against, you know, in employment, housing, access to education.
But what does that mean for this country, having the millions of people incarcerated, then having them released, having them not being able to get decent housing or decent jobs? And how then do you keep the crime rates down? Or is it just a matter of these people will be back in prison again and continue the cycle, and it will be new prisons? Or what's the rationale?
Well, you know, the way the system currently works, it is guaranteed to ensure that people will continue to cycle in and out of prison often for the rest of their lives. You know, the barriers to succeeding in the mainstream economy and society once you've been released from prison are so overwhelming. Not only can you be discriminated against, you know, for the rest of your life once you've been labeled a felon in employment, you've got to check that box on every employment application from Burger King clerk to accountant, you know, even if you've been convicted of a felony 20 years ago, you still got to check that box. You know, thousands of professional licenses are off limits to people convicted of felonies. You know, in some states you can't even get a license to be a barber if you've been convicted of a felony. For a minimum of 5 years, you're denied access to public housing. In fact, you know, your relatives can be evicted from public housing if they allow you to stay with them when you're recently released from prison. And, you know,
well, the Jim Crow laws, the old Jim Crow laws, it seems, were designed so that black people weren't competitive, mm-hmm. and that white people would continue to have the edge.
Yes.
But at a time of a global economy, is it a matter of keeping black people and brown people non-competitive?
Yes, and, you know, like I said, to a large extent, you know, now that relatively unskilled black labor is no longer deemed necessary, absolutely critical to the functioning of the economy, black people have been treated as largely disposable, no longer needed, no longer essential to the functioning of the economy. And so rather than invest in young folks of color and ensure that they get, you know, the best education that could, you know, prepare them for the new global economy, rather than invest in education and in job training, instead we're willing to spend billions of dollars warehousing folks in prison, you know, primarily for these nonviolent, often drug-related offenses.
Now, that seems, on the one hand, very short-sighted, because people are now saying that America, as a country, is losing its competitive edge.
Yes.
So wouldn't it be in the interest of this country to cultivate and nurture every mind possible?
Absolutely. You know, I point out in the book that, you know, Barack Obama himself has admitted to violating, you know, our drug laws on numerous occasions. Now, what if Barack Obama had been treated like a common criminal? You know, what if he hadn't been insulated by growing up in Hawaii and, you know, attending a predominantly white university and, you know, being, you know, miles away from the realities of ghetto life? What if he had been treated like a common criminal? What are the odds he would have gone on to Harvard Law School, much less become president of the United States? Almost none. The odds are he would be cycling in and out of prison.
There are those who would say the country might be better for it.
Well, that
given his politics.
there are, but there's no arguing that he's an extraordinarily talented individual.
Now, that assumes...
He never had the opportunity to develop those talents.
That assumes that those young men sitting there in prison now,
yes,
could be future Barack Obamas.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's what you're saying.
Exactly. We will never know how many of the young folks of color now trapped in the criminal justice system might well have been, you know, the next president of the United States, or a fantastic scientist might, you know, have the cure for AIDS. We will never know, because they have been disposed of.
Does it make sense for a country, accepting the scenario that you've just now outlined, to maintain millions of young men either in prison or out of the workforce, and a drain on what they would say would be the welfare system, having people cycle through prisons and wherever the future is for these people with broken lives? How can a country maintain its own health and well-being and economic success having a large caste system that you've just now described?
Well, it's an excellent question. And, you know, it's actually the same question that was asked during the Jim Crow era, which was, you know, how can a nation that, you know, holds itself out as, you know, a beacon of freedom keep, you know, an enormous class of people defined by race trapped in a permanent second-class status for life? And, you know, it was in part due to international embarrassment. You know, the United States was embarrassed by the fact that it had this racial caste system operating at a time when it was trying to hold itself out as the leader of the free world in World War II, and, you know, attempting to defeat the Nazis, that we ourselves were keeping black people trapped in a permanent racial undercaste. And here today, you know, with Barack Obama at the helm. Our nation is touted as having triumphed over race, as being the leader of the free world. And
so what would you say?
A new racial undercast.
Professor Alexander, what would you say when somebody would say to you, well, these people who are incarcerated did it to themselves? It was because of their choices to take drugs and commit whatever crimes they committed that got them arrested. So they're the ones who must be held responsible.
Well, again, we all make bad choices. We are all criminals.
Some get caught and some don't.
Every one of us has committed criminal offenses. Barack Obama committed criminal offenses. The question is, does it make sense for us to put people in cages for committing, you know, minor, nonviolent, drug-related offenses? Does it make sense for us as a nation to put people in cages, brand them as felons, and then relegate them to a lifetime of discrimination, scorn, and social exclusion? I say no, and it doesn't make sense for us to do that no matter what their color.
Okay.
But we don't do it to people of all colors.
What's the way out?
We do this overwhelmingly to poor people of color.
What's the way out of this? Especially when you have more penal institutions being built, where investments in penal institutions are on the stock market, gets high returns, where, as you mentioned, hundreds of thousands or millions of people are employed by these same institutions or the penal system. What's the way out?
I believe we have got to build a broad-based social movement to dismantle the new Jim Crow, to dismantle mass incarceration. And this movement must be multiracial and multiethnic. You know, the war on drugs was declared with black folks in mind, but it now harms people of all colors, all races, and all ethnicities. And this drug war, much like Jim Crow, was created in large part as an effort to pit poor and working class white folks against poor and working class people of color. And we have got to resist the divide and conquer tactics that have been used now for centuries in the United States to keep people who are poor, people who are working folks, divided against one another. You know, that's why I spend the first chapter of my book describing the cyclical rebirths of racial caste in America and in the ways in which white people have been pitted against poor whites, have been pit against poor folks of color again and again, triggering, you know, new systems of racial control that benefit economic and political elites but disadvantage the rest of us. So I hope that we will do the hard work of movement building to end not just mass incarceration, but this history and cycle of racial caste in America. We need a human rights movement, not a narrow civil rights movement, but a human rights movement that recognizes that each one of us, you know, should be entitled to quality education, quality health care, decent jobs, access to housing. Each and every one of us, no matter who we are or what we have done, titled to basic human rights.
Well, that is good to say, and it's also good to hear, but when it comes right down to the economics of it all, how do you bring something like that about?
Well, I think it has to begin with consciousness raising. You know, we are in deep denial as a nation about the existence of racial caste in America. We're in deep denial, and we're in denial for two reasons. One is that, you know, we have this idea that racial caste systems exist or are driven primarily by, like, hostile, open bigotry. And so because most people today don't think of themselves as racist and don't want to be racist, it's difficult for us to imagine that something akin to a caste system could be operating in the United States. But Martin Luther King Jr., you know, Dr. King warned of this kind of thinking more than 45 years ago. He said, you know, racial caste systems, slavery and Jim Crow, they are not driven primarily by bigotry. you know, decent people, you know, well-intentioned people supported Jim Crow. He even said that the Supreme Court justices who decided the Dred Scott case, you know, the infamous case which held, you know, the black man has no rights which the white man is bound to respect, even those justices, he said, were fundamentally decent people, but they were spiritually ignorant and indifferent to the plight of other races. He said it's racial indifference, the indifference to people of other races, that allows racial caste systems to emerge and to thrive. And the same is true today.
Well, one can talk
that there's open hostility and bigotry, but we as a nation have become indifferent to the plight and suffering of people of other races. It's no less true today than it was during the Jim Crow era, that many people are in denial about the harm and suffering of the new caste system.
Well, I would think that suffering might now be a little more apparent when you look at the economy of this country, how it collapsed in the wake of the subprime mortgage disaster, the number of people who were losing their houses, the number of people who are currently now unemployed, that this country isn't riding the economic wave of affluence that it once did. So I think people are a little bit more mindful of what it's like to do without and what it's like seeing people do without. But then the question is, okay, so there is an increase in the level of consciousness. What comes next?
Well, what comes next is that we are going to have to take action to end, you know, the mandatory minimum sentences, the harsh drug laws that treat drug use and drug abuse as a crime rather than a public health problem. We need to take action to end those policies and practices that have given rise to the expansion of our prison system. And we also need to end all forms of discrimination against those who have been branded felons. People in prison, as well as those who are released from prison, should be granted the right to vote in every state in the United States. They should be allowed to serve on juries. People should not be forced to check the box on employment applications for the rest of their life because they were once convicted of a felony. The box should be removed from applications so that people are judged based on their qualifications and what they bring to a job rather than, you know, the fact that they may have once committed something defined as a crime. People should have, you know, the human right to housing, whether they have been released from prison or not. They should have access to housing. Public housing should not be off limits. Food stamps should be available to someone, whether or not they were ever once caught with drugs. So all the forms of discrimination that lock people who have been branded felons into a permanent second-class status must be eliminated. You know, you can have all the job training and reentry programs in the world for folks released from prison, but as long as discrimination is perfectly legal against them for the rest of their lives, they will remain trapped in a permanent undercast.
Now, you have probably spoken nationwide on some of the major television stations, major radio stations, talking about your book. What kind of reception, when it comes to email, perhaps, or feedback from the public, have you received regarding some of your ideas?
Well, I have to say the reception has been overwhelmingly positive. You know, many people write to me saying, you know, finally someone is telling the truth about this system. And, you know, I myself did not always think this way. You know, I say in the introduction to my book that, you know, a little more than 10 years ago, I dismissed out of hand the idea that, you know, the drug war operates like a Jim Crow system or a new caste system. It was only years after working on issues of racial profiling and drug law enforcement in communities of color and working with individuals, you know, struggling to find employment and housing after being released from prison and helping to support their families, that I came to see that the criminal justice system is not just another institution in our society infected with conscious or unconscious bias, but it's a different beast entirely. It's the role it plays in our society today is one that is not primarily about crime control. It functions much more like a system of racial control than a system of crime control today.
How do you say to the person who might be unemployed himself, who might be white, that you have, what would you say, a moral obligation, perhaps to assist someone who is black get a job, if that assistance might mean that he would be competing against you?
Well, you know, I resist kind of the zero-sum game framing. You know, I think that too often, we are encouraged to think of ourselves as competing with each other rather than working together to create a bigger and more productive economy. What I would say to an unemployed white man today is join with your unemployed black brother and sisters who may or may not have been convicted of crimes. Join together to demand investment in your communities and job creation and training and education that will support your ability to thrive in the new economy. The reality is that when any of us do well and invest in each other, we create more jobs and more opportunities. There's a wonderful saying that says, lighting another candle does nothing to diminish your own flame. Working with others, joining together to demand job creation, green jobs, economic investment and development will benefit people of all colors. But we also do need to recognize that mass incarceration, the drug war, has not affected all communities equally. What it will take to repair the damage done to ghetto communities as a result of decades of neglect and disinvestment and a drug war is going to require a substantial commitment of time, energy, and resources. But this will be to the benefit of all.
Well, it seems like it's something that will also take decades. You can't take decades to break something down and have it repaired instantly. So for all of those who might be want to even become a part of the movement that you're talking about, what would you suggest that they do?
Well, I would first suggest that you become educated about the nature of the system by reading my book, The New Jim Crow, other books or other wonderful books. Like I mentioned, Texas Tough is another great book about the rise of the prison system and the ways in which mass incarceration is a backlash against the civil rights movement. There are great books available that can educate you about how this system of mass incarceration emerged, how it functions. My book describes in great detail, how we are able, in an era of so-called color blindness, how the law enforcement manages to target people on the basis of race, sweep them up by the thousands, lock them in cages, and all the forms of discrimination that follow. Educate yourself. Form book clubs, book groups, create community forums about these issues. Begin the conversation. In fact, one of the things I think that most important that can be done is to break the silence in churches. Many people who are formerly incarcerated tell me that, although you might think that church might be a place you could turn to when you're released from prison for support or, solace, solidarity, that many people feel that churches are unwelcoming to people after they're released from prison. Churches should be a place that people can come and receive support, that their families can receive support, that can provide job training, outreach, and organizing to end the forms of discrimination against people branded.
Well, you talk about education, you talk about the work that churches can do, you talk about the individual work that people can do in terms of forming forums. What about on the legislative level?
Yes. Well, first of all, you can support, a repeal of harsh mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses. And you can support the legalization of marijuana. I know that is difficult for many people to swallow, an idea that we should legalize marijuana. But the reality is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, a huge portion of drug arrests are for simple possession of marijuana. And often people are branded felons for just mere marijuana possession. And now, you know, most of the research indicates that marijuana is actually less harmful than alcohol or tobacco. It's a stigmatized drug, but there is no rational basis for putting people in cages and branding them criminals for the use or sale of marijuana. There's no better reason for doing it for marijuana than there is for alcohol or tobacco. And those who have problem with marijuana use need help and drug treatment, not being put in a cage. So, you know, we can end harsh mandatory minimum sentences, three strikes laws that warehouse people in prisons for decades or even for the rest of their lives. And, you know, on the legislative level, you can begin to support Ban the Box campaigns. There have been Ban the Box campaigns launched by All of Us or None, a wonderful organization dedicated to, it's an organization of formerly incarcerated people dedicated to ending discrimination against people labeled felons.
What, when it comes to voting?
Hmm?
When it comes to voting?
Yes, and also discrimination in employment.
Okay, now, in the 1 minute that we have left, is there something else that you think our listeners should know that we haven't talked about or that we've only passed over?
Well, the one thing I would add is that at the root of this caste system and every other caste system that has ever existed in the United States or anywhere around the world is the basic failure to care for our fellow humans, to extend to people of different races the same care, compassion, and concern that you extend to your own loved ones. I don't think any one of us would want someone we loved or cared about who was struggling with drug addiction to be put in a cage, branded a felon, and discriminated against for the rest of their natural lives. That's not how we treat people we care about. But the problem is, who is cared about in the United States today has a lot to do with race. And we learned the wrong lesson in the civil rights movement. You know, our goal should not be to go colorblind, to be blind to people of other races, but to care about them.
Do you know, we will have to end on that note, and it's a very powerful note, that we should not be colorblind, but that we should care. I would like to thank you very much for being a guest on this special edition of the Shedding Light Show. It's Professor Michelle Alexander. Her book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Thank you.
And I'd certainly like to thank our listeners for being with us. And the next time you talk with us, you might talk with me and Bert Hale. So thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.